use my axe! I'm hungry!
Welcome to Get to Work, Hurley, the podcast for anyone who has ever been frustrated by the professional writing life. Thank you for continuing to listen in here at this, our third episode. I say our. I guess that's kind of true. My spouse and I work very hard to be a good team, a good, fabulous team doing things. It's a rough life. A lot of people ask me how I'm able to do all the things that I do and have a spouse who is a true partner and very supportive. So on this podcast, I've poured myself a drink and I'm going to be tackling a few topics of the day. I'll talk a little bit about SweCon, which was a big convention I just came back from in Uppsala, Sweden, which was really fabulous. I'm also going to talk about constraints or the ownership that a lot of publishers and industry professionals, some pressure that they may put on you to own your time. also some audio rights grabs, some issues with non-compete clauses. I'll be talking about that and also about how we kind of constrain our choices as far as thinking that there are only two, good versus evil, red versus blue, the end versus the beginning. And, so I will be tackling a bunch of those. But first, I want to remind you that this podcast is brought to you by the Patreon supporters over there at patreon.com/CameronHurley. That's Cameron with a K. You can go ahead and throw in a buck a month or more to get some special goodies and also support this work that I am sitting down doing. Also support my scotch drinking, the scotch here that I have poured next to me. Thank you so much for continuing listening. Okay, so let's talk about SweCon. SweCon, I was invited to go to this convention last year. It was actually the first convention that invited me as a guest of honor. That's really cool when that happens. I'd never been asked. Like, people always assume, this is great. So people always assume that writers, publishers, or the convention itself pays for them to go to events. No. For 99% of us, that is not at all what happens. We come to conventions on our own dime. If we are very, very lucky as panelists, our memberships are comped. At Worldcon, that is not automatically happen. It happens if they have a surplus and they feel they can pay panelists convention fee. So you pay for everything as a panelist when you come to these events. The only people who do not pay are guests of honor, usually. But it was really cool. SweCon was great. They paid for my train tickets. They paid for my everything. And then also when I got there, it turned out they had the SF Bookshop, which has three locations in Stockholm, Gothenburg, and a southern city, I forget, also paid for me to actually get on a train with my husband and go from Stockholm to Gothenburg, do an event there, do a signing, pay for the train for me to come back. And then, you know, I went up to Uppsala with the convention staff at SweCon. It was one of those moments. How do I explain this? My husband and I, and I paid my husband's plane ticket. That was luckily they paid mine, but I paid my husband's. And, you know, we had the first couple of days we were there, we paid out of pocket for our own stuff. But when we got there, once we got to the convention, you get a stipend for food and stuff. So it was awesome. It's great. I could afford to go because my day job lets me work from anywhere. And so the first few days I was actually working remotely. And then after that, I took some time off and did the actual convention proper. So the hotel that the SF Bookshop put us in was really lovely. Really lovely. The hotel was right on the waterfront. It was a lovely room. It was like a corner room, I believe. You know, beautiful bathroom, beautiful king bed. I mean, we were exhausted, so we didn't really have time to kind of enjoy it. But it was, you know, late at night. I think we got there at 10 o'clock at night. But it was still light outside because it's Sweden in summer. I remember opening up, you know, the windows because a lot of places don't have air conditioning. It was in an older building. It's tough to have air conditioning. So we opened up the windows and got the fan going, and it was beautiful. And they had little bottles of brandy, you know, on the sideboard and all sorts of mini bar stuff, which we didn't touch because I didn't want them to have to pay for it. It's the first time anyone's ever, like publishers, anyone has ever paid for me to do an event, to do anything. As an author, I'm, you know, my first book came out in 2011. I'm working on my eighth book. And it was the first time I felt like a superstar as a writer. It's like, oh, I'm a writer, I guess. I guess I'm sort of famous, maybe. Maybe I'm sort of to like 100 people, which is what I say at work. I'm like, it's like being a YouTube star. I'm like famous to 100 people. So it's weird. It's a strange thing. We have these expectations of what being a successful writer is, but being a success is. You know, we think of Castle from the show where, you know, he lives in this New York City apartment and he doesn't have to worry about money and he spends so much money, just screws off all the time and hardly ever writes. You know, he writes like one day a week or whatever it is, and then gets like the whole book done in that day. And even though I know none of that's true, I know it's not true. I know a lot of writers, the writers who I do know who work full time, I mean, as writers who work full time as writers, either tend to have, you know, a spouse who, you know, keeps the health insurance, or they are putting out a book every 2 or 3 months, or they are not making a lot of money. And again, they have a spouse who makes the money that is regular, that helps them survive. Very few make John Scalzi money. You know, some of them do very well. They're making, you know, six figures or more a year, seven figures for some. But it's very, very rare. It's very rare. Even though I know it's rare, even though I know it intellectually, I keep thinking, I was standing this hotel room looking out at the water thinking, this is what it is to be a real writer. Like, this is it. This is, there's no, like, you always are pushing for the next milestone or the next thing at where you feel like, okay, now I'm successful. Now I'm a success. Now I've reached the top of the mountain. And the reality is there's no top to the mountain. There is this. This is it. This is being a writer. It was just a very interesting moment for me. You know, I was being treated so well. And you just sort of have that moment where you go, there's no more mountain. And it was both exhilarating because it's amazing to be treated so well, and sort of deflating because you still have all these expectations, right? You want, everyone, all of us want to be million-dollar writers. Nobody wants to have a day job. I love my day job. I love marketing and advertising. It's very enjoyable to me. But when you sit as a kid and you want to be a writer, you know, you don't think, well, I will maintain this day job and work remotely and be constantly working. It's Saturday evening here, and I've been working all day on this book and working all weekend on this book that's due. And you sort of wonder, you go, well, when does it get easier? Or when can you not push so hard? Because you get tired. And the answer is never. The answer is there's no climbing, and you're just going to keep climbing. So you can certainly slow down, because, you know, and take time off. And imagine you're climbing this mountain, and you're like, hey, this tier of this mountain's really nice. I'm going to stay here and plant a garden for a while and hang out and just enjoy the view from here. And lots of people stay at the tier, but some people go the next tier, the next tier, the next tier. But the reality is there's no top. There's no end. There's no standing on top of Everest and saying, I have reached the summit. It doesn't exist. What exists is this experience that you have, whatever that experience is as of right now. There is no external validation that's going to come and say, you are a real writer now. You are a success. Unless you're a million-dollar writer. But even then, you're a million-dollar writer, or you... I talk to lots of writers who sell tons. They're like, well, but I've never won a Hugo. And I'm like, I will trade you one of my Hugos for half of your sales. I'll do it. I'll do it right now. They're like, no, no deal. I'm like, yeah, that's right. There's always something. There is always something that we strive for. And I thought that was very interesting. I had this moment. I was doing a signing at the English bookshop, in Uppsala. Lovely people. And I'm sitting there between a newer author. I want to say Catherine Arden. Gosh, I hope I get that right. I can edit it if I don't. and of course, Anne Leckie, because she was also a guest of honor. And Catherine was there. And, you know, Catherine's book is sold. It's a bestseller. She was hanging out in Sweden for a few months and chilling. And she had one book out and was, I think the second one was about ready to come out. Anne has her three books with a fourth coming out. And they sat all the books down in front of us. Then they sat all my books down. Like, I literally, like, was like, holy shit, I've written a lot of books. Because they'd ordered all my books. The bookstore had ordered my books. God bless them, everyone. They are wonderful human beings. And they had brought copies of every single one of my books. So I've got, like, these seven books sitting in front of me. These huge piles. And I was like, I felt so strange. Because here's, you know, Catherine bumming around Sweden. Because in writing, oh my gosh. My dream in my whole life. And then Anne, who, you know, the ancillary books took off and did very well. And she's able to write full time. And here I am with these seven books. Seven books. And now I want to drink. It was just funny. It was just funny. There's so much luck in this business. And there's so much timing. And there's so much. You can't measure yourself by a lot of the things that American society tells us we should measure ourselves by. That we should measure ourselves by how big our house is, how many things we can buy, how much money we make. Instead of things like, again, how healthy we are, how happy we are, how content we are, how much our work has changed people's lives. We have very skewed ideas of success in the United States. And a lot of that is also just, again, it's living in a consumer capitalist society. Again, I'm in marketing and advertising. We don't want people to feel that they've reached the top of the mountain. you never want them to feel like they are perfect. There must always be imperfect. There must always be something else to strive for. You must want more money so that you could do some other exclusive thing that no one else can do. That keeps people climbing, right? They keep climbing the mountain. Which is exhausting, and it induces a lot of anxiety and doesn't make people happy. The U.S. is one of the least happy places for people because it's by design. That's how you get people to buy things, is ensure that they are never satisfied. But anyhow, those were some thoughts that I had just about the climb. Climbing Everest, you know, I had an amazing time at that convention. And as I said, it was one of the things that was absolutely amazing was that they took the chance, the organizers, great fan organizers. Everyone does these things at these conventions as volunteers. So they're doing these things as volunteers. They were absolutely fabulous in that they thought of the idea, let's invite both Cameron Hurley and Anne Leckie as guests of honor. And it was absolutely fabulous. Siri was our other one. She was the other guest of honor, and she was a Norwegian writer. And she was out. We all got on like a house on fire. We had way too much fun. Siri Peterson. She was absolutely fabulous. Putting the three of us, you know, together was pretty much a recipe for hilariousness and trouble. It was decided that Anne and I should do a panel on how to write strong male characters. Because it's hilarious. And again, there have been some, you know, oh, how to write straight characters. I think it was at WisCon or some other convention had done it. It was fun and hilarious. So they thought, okay, we've got Cameron Hurley and Anne Leckie. Let's do how to write strong male characters. And I thought I would do it straight. Right? I was going to do it in a straight, no pun intended, in a straight way. But Anne and I started talking, and Anne was just like, she just went to town and was basically flipping all those stupid ass things that we hear on these goddamn endless how to write strong female characters panels. Oh, just imagine that women are humans just like you. You know, I fucking hate those panels. There was one where the assumption, it was from a guy on the panel. He's like, well, you know, we all bring a straight male perspective to both. And I was just like, what do you mean we? What do you mean we, dude? Anyway, lots of annoying things. So basically, Anne and I channeled all those dudes that we have been on panels with who are absolutely clueless, and we flipped the genders on everything and told people how to write strong male characters by making them humans. Men are human too. And I said, yeah. And we pretended we were those dudes. We were those dude writers that annoyed the shit out of us. So I was like, yeah. Or when I read men's books and I send them these long emails about how I think they should have written their books. And for some reason, they never get back to me. I think it's because they feel so overwhelmed by my brilliance or something like that. So all the dumbass things. It's really funny, though, because the one that Anne couldn't go along with where it was like, yes, Anne, we are the, you know, saviors of science fiction. There's a straight line from, you know, Le Guin, Joanna Russ to us. We are the next generation of blah, blah. And she's like, I don't know how long I can spin that one. Which was funny. Male writers we have been on panels with who have said, you know, my book is amazing. My book is awesome. I'm awesome. I'm great. I can name a few off the top of my head right now who do that all the time. But it's part of their persona, right? It's part of their persona. It was funny that, and that was the thing, right? Where, oh, you know, I don't know if I can do, if I can channel it that far. Again, to have the confidence of a mediocre white guy. And so you always go to that where you're just like, oh man, if I only had the confidence to say and do all these things. And so we kind of channeled the worst guys in publishing, and we gave our advice to men on how to write great male characters, and women on how to write, and all the people, everyone, how to write strong male characters. So it was a really exceptional panel, and I did just want to give a public shout out to that convention for choosing three female guests of honor, and especially for choosing Anne and I together, because I think a lot of people at general conventions look at me and Anne and say, well, they both write about gender. We don't want two writers write about gender. Who are guests of honor. We don't want that. Which I know sounds ridiculous, right? Because again, oh, well, George R. R. Martin and Joe Abercrombie both write about war, and we don't want to have two guests of honor who write about war, right? But as women writers, you run into this all the time where someone goes, well, I already have a woman writer. Either you're the woman writer, or, well, this writer writes about gender, so I don't want to put it on this with this other writer who writes about gender. But in fact, it was amazing. Putting Anne and I on panels was amazing. I felt at the time, I was like, wow, I don't know that I would have gotten this opportunity at a US con, because I don't know how many fan-run conventions in the US would have even considered making us both guests of honor at the same time. You know, male authors, that's not even like a consideration. Well, these two men both write about space. Why would we have them both as guests of honor? Hey, Greg Bear and John Scalzi both write about science fiction. We can't have them both guests of honor at the same time. But yeah, I would like to put a shout out there. You can have absolute magic happen at your conventions when you put really awesome people together. I will channel my inner mediocre white man and say, we were great. And there are a lot of people that you could put on panels together and make GOHs together who will also be great. You can have two women of color. Think of that as your GOHs. Amazing. I know. And you could have two women. You could have three women. You could have two trans women. You could have all of these things. It's like no one ever questions having two male guests of honor. Anyhow, so that was my rant on that, and that went on probably too long. I wanted to just make that shout out and tell everybody how fabulous SweetCon was. And hey, if any other Nordic countries would like to invite me to be a GOH, I am more than happy to, because that was a lot of fucking fun. The next topic I wanted to tackle this month was the issue of time and writers in time. I recently had some folks ping me, and I'm trying to do this as anonymously as possible, but I recently had some people ping me and say I was very much dividing my time in many different ways. And these are professional people in the industry. And in much the same way that you don't tell Patrick Rothfuss or George R. R. Martin, you know, stop living your life and finish your goddamn book, don't tell me that either. And the reason for that is this. And in their cases, certainly there may be the different issues. But in my case also, not only is it that no one owns your time. Fans don't own your time. Publishers don't own your time. If they want, if they're like, hey, you're taking too long, I'm more than happy to send an advance back. Go, okay, well, I'm taking too long. But the cold hard equations are that I cannot give a book 100% of my time. I cannot. Financially, I simply can't. For The Broken Heavens, the book that I have coming out now, that I'm working on right now, I was paid $15,000. I was paid, I think, $5,000 on signing. And then I think I'll get the next $7,000 when I turn it in. And then the rest will come when it's on publication or something. $5,555. I don't remember what it is. But it's not a lot of money, to be frank. It's slightly more than I was paid for the other two, but that's simply because when I signed the contract for the other two, they weren't sure how they were going to do, and then they came out and they were a little more successful and we got them up to 15. I think they should have made a lot more. I think we're gonna earn that back. Again, having talked to other writers, it's like, hey, there are people selling a lot less than you, making a lot more, and I'm like, oh. <You know? laughs> But I am stuck inside of these older contracts before things started selling really well, especially Stars Are Legion is doing fairly well. Mirror Empire and Empire Sun have both earned out. All my books have earned out except for Legion and Geek Feminist. And Geek Feminist is close. Geek Feminist is close. I think we're $5,000. I think $5,000. I was paid $17,500. So I think that we're going to get close, especially with some foreign rights that we're selling. So we're gonna get there here. And there's some sales coming up for Geek Feminist. At those kind of rates, with my health the way that it is and the things that I have to pay, a lot of people are like, whoa, $30,000, that's more than I make at my day job. I'm like, well, that's great. The reality is, I'm right now, even with health insurance, I'm paying $1,500 a month for my medical stuff. That doesn't include what my spouse pays, and again, and I'm the breadwinner here, so there's also his stuff. We both have chronic conditions and pre-existing conditions. We are paying a lot of fucking money every month for health stuff, which always is why I always get really pissed off and be like, oh, they don't pay their share. Fucking pay my share. Go fuck yourself. The issue is that the U.S. system is 5 times more expensive than any other system in the Western world because it's capitalist and all messed up. It's long, you know. Healthcare is complicated. Oh, it's complicated. Anyway, take a drink. It's complicated. So when we talk about time, a lot of people don't realize one of the reasons I work so hard and I work constantly is that I was in a place at one point where I was living on expired insulin. I was living on paying payments and things with, you know, credit cards, paying minimum payments, living in a friend's spare bedroom, trying to make ends meet. When I tell my parents about this time in my life, they're always like, well, we could have helped you. I said, no, you couldn't. I did ask for your help. I did ask for your help. And you guys said, we have $1,000. That is literally all the money we have. And that's all we can do to help you. And at that point, you know, we can try and put you up if you come home. But we've got nothing. When I look back at that time in my life and realize, you know, I was working temp jobs and coasting between insurances, just buying insurance, not because it would pay for anything at that point, buying insurance so that my pre-existing clock didn't start ticking. Because a lot of people don't know, before ACA, if you went more than 2 months without health insurance, you'd be considered having a pre-existing condition. And then they could deny all of your claims for anywhere from 24 to 48 months, even if you got onto an employer-sponsored plan. Scary shit. That was my worst, deadliest fear. So some people are like, why do you work so hard? And hey, you're making $15,000 for a novel. Well, first of all, you're not. Your agent makes 15% of that. You pay 30% of it in taxes. Then the payment is cut up over several years. Again, we did this contract a couple years ago. So I got the first little chunk of it a couple years ago. And then I'll get the next chunk when I turn this in, hopefully soon. And I'll get the next chunk when it actually comes out in January. So you don't get $15,000 a year. You don't get $20,000 a year, which so far is the most I've been paid for a book. I've been offered more, but it's a long story. And when you look at those sorts of numbers that you come back with, and you look at the things that I have to deal with and the anxieties and terror of dying in the street, living on expired insulin, I have to hustle. a lot of everyone, but certainly millennials also have learned that there is the hustle. And I am constantly hungry for money and for ways to make money and improve my position and get what I'm owed and what I'm worth. And more I've realized a lot of people have been telling me, they're like, you've earned out like all of your contracts and all your books. They're like, if you're earning out that quickly, they're like, you're way under advanced. And I'm like, I know. Again, you do get royalties after you earn out. And so I do make a little more in royalties every year, which is great. When it comes to time, everyone's going to want to have their project at the top of your list. So your publisher wants your book to be at the top of your list. Your employer, your day job employer, wants day job work to be at the top of your list. Your patrons, you know, I have a Patreon, want their work to be at the top of the list. You know, your agent wants your next book to be at the top of the list. Everybody wants your time and they want it 100%, but nobody wants to pay for it. They don't want to pay, you know, $1 million for it. Some of them do. Again, you get to the 1% deals for writers, and that's fine. If you want to pay me, you know, $200,000 a book, I'm fine to put your book at the top of my list. But the reality is that when you're making what I make with novels and short stories and things, is that you have to really hustle and you have to figure out what is good for short-term money and what's good for the long-term money and how to balance your writing so that you are getting everything that you need out of it. This is me sort of speaking to newer writers, younger writers, people who are really getting in the business. I want you to keep in mind that nobody owns you for $20,000, okay? Nobody owns you. And I want to talk about that because I think it's incredibly important, especially here in the US. I think we're seeing it more and more where a lot of companies are demanding loyalty, but they don't want to actually pay you for it. They don't want to give you any sort of social safety net or guarantees or anything like that. There were times where you'd be locked into contracts where they're like, we can't fire you for 3 years. And in return, you agree to do X, Y, and Z. And they couldn't. They couldn't fire you legally. The madman contracts, you know. They had to pay you out or keep paying you when they laid you off. But these things don't happen anymore. They expect absolute loyalty for zero money and for shitty health insurance. God, my health insurance is shitty. So we have a lot of things. It's one of the reasons I had to negotiate the salary. I had to negotiate over there because I knew I was going to be paying $10,000 extra a year in health costs. So I want to tell you and just remind you that your time is yours. And we do not live in the dystopic world where you have a contract where they own you literally body, mind, and soul. We don't have that. I don't want to ever have that. And I want you to remember that when someone says to you, hey, you know, you sure are spending a lot of time in short stories. Where's that novel? Instead, I want you to come back and go, great. They want that novel and they want to harass me about it. Take your $5,000 back. And I will get back to doing what I was doing because I can make $5,000 in 2 months on Patreon. So remember that. No one owns you. And people get very upset at this whole idea, especially fans. And I understand. I didn't used to understand it, but now I totally get it. Where fans go, I'm invested in a series. You owe me this series. You owe me this because I paid you money. Well, no, I don't. Writers don't. It's nice. It's something I certainly take seriously as a responsibility. I like to finish all my books and finish all my series in a reasonable amount of time. But people need to also understand you are not paying for a human. When you pay for a book, you're paying for a physical object. You're paying for the book. That is how it's supposed to work in society right now. Again, we are not supposed to buy and sell human beings. You don't owe people your life. In your time. How you portion that out and how you decide that is, you know, completely up to you. But I just want to remind you of that if you ever find yourself in those situations. We are, frankly, in a time period here in a Western country where we need to hustle really hard because there is no social safety net. I hustle as hard as I do because I realize that I am one job loss or catastrophe away from bankruptcy and losing everything that I have. Even with the salary that I make right now, the salary in the books and all this, I do okay. But I have only done okay for a couple years, 2-3 years now. I could lose it all tomorrow. So I need to hustle. gotta hustle. I hate the anxiety that we have to live with in America. Again, one of the things coming back from Sweden, it was quite sobering when I realized that it was a country people could live in and they could pursue their dreams and they could, you know, go to work and enjoy themselves without worrying about what happens if, you know, they broke their leg or they wanted to have kids. You know, they could take a year off to watch their kids. They have affordable childcare and pensions. You know, people have pensions in retirement. You're not going to have to worry. More and more, you know, I mean, I've done the calculations and I think it was something like I need to have $1.5 million in the bank if I want to be able to take out like $50,000 a year, again, in 30 years. So I think it, which will be like 20. But if I want to take out, you know, $50,000 to $70,000 a year and try to survive, I need to somehow compile $1.5 million. And I was like, how is that even fucking possible? How is that possible? So when people come to you and say, I want your time, you had better understand, you better know how much that time is worth. More and more, we're seeing a lot of publishers who have non-compete clauses, who are trying to say, well, you can't have any other books come out within a year of this other book, which is bullshit. Tell them to fuck themselves. A lot of those you can get down to 2 to 4 months between books, which you really should have anyway, just because you'll go insane trying to get out that many books that quickly and then promote them and all of those things. So keep an eye on those. So speaking of non-compete clauses, I did also want to talk about Michael J. Sullivan, who is a great advocate as far as sharing information as a writer and sharing information with writers, was talking about on Reddit how his publisher, he was at Penguin Random House, had said that they basically were not going to sign a contract with him because he'd already sold audio rights on his next book. Now, Michael J. Sullivan is a guy who makes quite a lot of money, over 6 figures usually for each of his titles. He started out as a self-publisher. I also want to mention he, you know, ran his own marketing firm, so he knows how to market, which is, I think, if you're going to be a self-published author, is vital. You should know something about marketing. He does a good job. His wife does work as his agent. Basically, she negotiates all the contracts. This is wonderful because, again, 15% can stay in house, but it also means that he doesn't necessarily have the leverage that a larger agency may be able to give him. And I think that may have, you know, played a part in we're not doing any audio deals. And they were like, well, we already sold audio. And they said, well, sorry. Even though this is a guy who sells a lot of books. It was really worrying to me that we are seeing publishers make that proclamation. That's really disturbing. That's really disturbing. There's increasingly all of these rights grabs. I know I was doing one with Simon and Schuster. It was a saga. They wanted comic book rights. And I'm like, what the fuck would you want comic book rights with this to be bundled up with everything else? I understand more and more, you know, electronic rights, ebooks, but there were times you didn't sell ebooks. Again, J.K. Rowling, she'll tell you all about it. You know, how great to be you. I know several authors who actually own the ebook rights to their entire backlist because they came out during times when people were like, why would I want e-rights? Why would I want digital editions? And I think a lot of people are seeing audio as the next sort of big thing. It's becoming more and more popular. And again, I don't know why necessarily that is. It's certainly always been very popular among people who do a lot of line work, truck drivers. Truck drivers are a huge, huge market for audio. So audio is becoming more and more important for a lot of authors. And it really depends, of course, on the type of author. I was actually talking to another writer recently and they had said, hey, you know, well, one of the reasons I do so great in audio is the books are heavy on dialogue. So dialogue books tend to do really, really well. If you are not, you know, huge on narrative and a description and things and you focus a lot on dialogue, you can do very well in audio, very well. So more and more houses have been trying to do this grab. And it really bothers me because, of course, they want to grab it all and they don't want to pay you for it. Instead, they're like, oh, we'll split whatever we get 50-50 from Audible. Let me tell you, again, Geek Feminist, I sold it for $17.5 without audio rights to Tor, and then I turned around and sold $3,000 to Recorded Books, I believe, and they did the audio version of it. Same thing with Saga Press. We'd actually allowed Saga to have an option for the Stars or Legion audiobook. They declined. So they'd paid me the 20, and then I went out and I think we got another three, yeah, from Recorded Books again. But what they want to do is say, oh, we'll split it with you. So I would have made $1,500. They would have made $1,500. Fuck that. Right? Like, they want these rights, and then not only do they not exploit them, so they don't do a fucking thing with them, but then they go and they want to take, you know, they want to get the big pie. And I get why. It's a business decision. It's understandable. But let's be fair, you know, let's be reasonable, you know, let's do an audio. Here's your offer without audio. Here's your offer with audio. If you can't at least come up $3,000 for audio, why would we do a deal? I certainly have a lot of big issues with that. And I think we should all be concerned as novelists with some of these rights grabs. And I'm not very happy about this audio stirring as well. I just wanted to throw that in as something we should be thinking about and keeping an eye on. So finally, on today's podcast, I want to talk about how we keep believing we only have two choices. And I tease this a little bit in the opening. The Invisibilia podcast, which I think Gwenda Bond turned me on to, is really good. It's a podcast host on NPR. And it was really great. It was about the latest one, which I just listened to, but it's about lots of different cognitive things, different ways we view the world. And the latest one was about this little community where there were some people who believed that black bears who lived around there, they could be tamed. They were totally nice. They were like dogs. It was, you could feed them out of your hand. And they interacted with these bears in this way. And then there were people who were absolutely terrified of the bears and were like, these are wild creatures and they should not be, you know, domesticated. They're coming into human areas. This is really dangerous. We're saying for a dangerous situation. 70 people since 1900 have been killed by black bears in the United States, to which I would then, of course, remind people how many people are killed by dogs every year in the United States. But of course, there are more dogs. We live with dogs. There's just more opportunities for people to be horrible to animals and make them aggressive. So, you know, it's an interesting, wild animals are wild animals. At the end of the day, I totally understand that. A squirrel could bite you and give you rabies. Sure. So could a dog. So could your Aunt Susie. You know? But it was really interesting because, again, both sides, and this is why this is so important, both sides believe they were absolutely true. And there was it was a black and white decision. It was, this is good and this is bad for both sides. They talked about how interesting it was because it's a very Western idea. There is one choice or the other choice, a good choice and a bad choice. That the truth is black and white. The truth is obvious. There is always a moral choice. There is always a right choice. It's a very Greek idea where, you know, there's an either or. They talked about how in a lot of Eastern cultures, they recognize that it's not always either or. And I think some of this also comes from religion, right? It's sinful or not sinful. It's godly or not godly. A lot of it's based in religion and Christian religion. So in Eastern societies, they recognize that, you know, not only is there not a this person's right or this person's wrong, the actual truth could lie between those. It could be none of those things. It could be, you could all be wrong. And there's an acknowledgement of that I don't feel it really melded sort of with a struggle that I've had with writing The Broken Heavens, in that I had set my character up the entire time, one of my characters up the entire time to make a certain choice at the end of the novel. She is presented with two choices. They're both horrible, horrible, awful choices. It's like the end of Mass Effect 3, right? Where they're all shitty choices. I wanted to set her up with that because I felt that was just what I wanted, that impossible choice. The more distance I have gotten from, you know, my original idea of the novel, the more the world has changed around me, the more I've realized that I really didn't like that ending. I really didn't like either choice that she had. And it was frustrating to me that I'd set up this novel for her to have these two choices. So it's frustrating with myself. I was talking to my husband the other night, and we were sitting around the fire outside and I was having a few drinks, as I do. And he's like, oh, do we have to have a meat suit conversation? Which is a running joke for us, because that was how he helped me in my book Infidel to kind of get myself out of a similar thing where I've written myself into a corner. I said, yeah, I'm having trouble with this book. I'm like, the ending is just wrong. If you haven't heard these two choices, they're shitty choices. They're not choices that I want her to make. They don't. Either one betrays a lot of the promises I've made to my readers about things I will and will not write about. I think they're wrong now. And he said, you know, okay, well, how does this stuff work? You know, the end of the novel is like, well, it works this way, and here's how she makes a choice. And he looks at me and he goes, you realize you're writing a fantasy, right? And in a fantasy, you can do whatever the fuck you want. So why? Why does she have to have two choices? Literally. And we explain, you know, we talked about the conceit thing that I have at the end. And he's like, literally, there are all these other choices that can be made because this is a fantasy novel. And you are making up how this final epic end machine magic thing works. Why are there only two choices? And I was like, oh. And it was such a great example. And I was like, oh, shit. And I literally, went back last night. Yeah. And I went and I rewrote the whole ending and it just flowed. And it was just like, oh, shit, this is it. And finally, I had the end. I was like, this is the ending we actually need to be going for. And that's why I was building toward that ending, right? With everything. And it's been taking so long and I hate it. And then I realized, oh, now we can build toward this other ending. And that makes way more sense for this other choice. And now I feel a little freer to write. But it was interesting. It was a beautiful example of how we believe we have two choices. And we believe that because we are, you know, we're literally making up worlds. But I see people do this all the time. Well, historically, this didn't happen. Well, historically, I'm like, you're writing a fantasy novel. First of all, your history's fucked and you're wrong about all those things you thought were real. But second of all, it's a fucking fantasy novel. You have literally made this entire book. You've made this entire society. You've made the made-up machine. You've made the made-up magic. Make up something different. But we get so enamored of this. It's this or this. It's either or. It's right or not right. And the reality is, we can do fucking anything. We are wizards. We are wizards. And we can do what we like. And that is something I want everyone to kind of leave with and to think about, is that you're a fucking wizard. You're a wizard. And if you are going out into the world thinking that there's only two choices, there's only, you know, this political party is right and this political party is wrong, and this action is right and this action is wrong. Sometimes, yes, correct, that works, and I'll agree with you on lots of those points. But sometimes the truth is absolutely gray. And we get so caught up in black or white choices and in moral versus amoral choices. And I do think it's a strong religious component. My grandmother was Catholic, and so is my father, and so I have some of that going on. So I completely understand kind of where that comes from, that there is a good or a bad. And the reality is that sometimes there is not a good or a bad. There is what is. And I think we need to consider that and think about that, especially when interacting with each other, when making our own decisions, as this character needs to do in the book that I'm writing, and really sort of step out and think differently, not only about our own work, but about the world that we live in. Are things really black or white? It's good or not good. There are very few things in the world, it turns out, that you can make this sort of snap judgments on. And I think we really need to consider that and consider how we can all see this exact same events and believe that there is something different that's going on that happens all the time. It's quite a common thing. Again, listen to the Invisibilia podcast. It's been very good. So I will leave you with that here. And I will go and watch some murder shows and write more about this character who doesn't just have two choices, because I'm a wizard. And I hope you enjoy being a wizard too.